This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
They're going to come tomorrow. And when they do, somebody's going to get hurt.
That's our first guest, Justin Theroux, in the first episode of the HBO series The Leftovers, as a police chief trying to hold his small town together. The Leftovers is about the people left on Earth after 2% of the population vanished in a split second. No one knows why. Maybe it's the rapture, maybe not. But everyone on Earth is grieving, and many have lost their bearings trying to deal with such inexplicable loss. Justin Theroux has also worked in comedy. He co-wrote Tropic Thunder with Ben Stiller and wrote the forthcoming sequel to Stiller's male model comedy Zoolander. The Leftovers was created by Tom Perrotta, who wrote the novel it's based on, and Damon Lindelof, who also co-created Lost. Terry spoke with Theroux last Wednesday.
Justin Theroux, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for being here. I love the series. The premise of The Leftovers is that these deaths, the sudden vanishing of 2% of the population, these deaths are inexplicable, but the people left on Earth have to figure out how to continue living in the face of grief and in the face of inexplicable loss. Where did you go in yourself to, what did you do to get into that frame of mind where there's this inexplicable thing that's happened and it might be God's will that it happened? It might be something like the rapture, might have nothing to do with that. If it is God's will, like, why are you still here?
In general, is either atheist or deeply agnostic. And I think that's part of the fun struggle for him in the first season is sort of just the firm belief that he can wrap his arms around things. And if he holds tight enough, he can actually make things happen or affect a change. I think speaking sort of at 40,000 feet about the show, everyone reacts differently and has a different kind of neurosis or something that sets in and different reactions to it. And I think it's one of the fun sort of frustrating and I know it frustrates certain people who watch the show, or at least in the first season, was that Damon Lindelof was very, and Tom Perrotta were very clear that they were not going to answer this question. And the people watching were going to have to sort of live in the same unknown that the characters are. So in that sense, everyone's in kind of real time together, which I thought was a great way of sort of, keeping people in the present while watching the show.
The showrunner for The Leftovers, Mimi Leder, was quoted in The New York Times as saying that The Leftovers is about the characters, it's about family, and that she wants the show to stay on the characters' faces. She says you don't want to miss one single blink of an eye. What does that mean for you as one of the actors? Because the camera is often on your face. And in some ways, we see your face more frequently than we actually hear you speak. And you're usually registering some kind of trouble. Feelings of guilt, hurt, pain, confusion, the burden of responsibility. Your eyes tear up sometimes, as they've done this season.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you're aware that the camera is on your face and that your face has to be expressing the things you're not saying.
Mm.
So if it's a nonverbal scene for you, what do you think about in order to express what it is, the subtleties of what you need to express without overly emoting?
To a certain extent, it's a technical question because it's, where is the camera? What lens are they using? How close are they? And then, as far as the personal stuff, that's usually just whatever I always try and ground it in whatever's written, So if it's a scene where I'm telling my daughter I'm getting a divorce, I can ground it in that, and it's making it believable for myself. I know where to go for that. And Damon, I actually wish, or I hope at some point Damon publishes the scripts because they're really beautifully written and read very fast. And oftentimes in the descriptions of what's happening in the scene, it might be a 4-line scene or an 8-line scene. He's very specific about, hold on, Kevin, or hold on, Jill, her eyes moisten, she turns away. He's very specific about that kind of direction in the descriptives and the action. And they're beautifully written. So in a weird way, he's done a lot of my work for me.
So you've been working on the sequel to Zoolander. You wrote the screenplay for Zoolander 2, which is tentatively scheduled for release in February. And Zoolander is about a male, the first movie was about a male model played by Ben Stiller, who is incredibly vacuous and self-absorbed. So I want to play a short clip before we talk about the sequel that you're working on. I want to play a short clip from the first Zoolander, and this is from the beginning of the film. It's the VH1 Fashion Awards ceremony, and one of the categories is Male Model of the Year. So Zoolander has already won this three times, and he's up for his fourth win, but he's against a newcomer named Hansel, who's played by Owen Wilson. And each of the nominees has a video to show who they are, you know, before the award is announced. So here's Lenny Kravitz, who's hosting, introducing the nominees on stage and introducing the video for Hansel, the male model played by Owen Wilson.
Here are the nominees for Male Model of the Year.
Young, hot, brash, with more covers in his first year than any rookie model ever, and an attitude that says, who cares? It's only fashion.
That Hansel's so hot right now.
I hear a lot of words like beauty and handsomeness and incredibly chiseled features. To me, that's like a vanity that self-absorption that I try to steer clear of. I dig the bungee. I mean, for me, it's just the way I live my life. I grip it and I rip it. I live with a lot of flair. I live it on the edge where I gotta be. I wasn't like every other kid, you know, who dreams about being an astronaut. I was always more interested in what bark was made out of on a tree. Richard Gere is a real hero of mine. Sting would be another person who's a hero. The music that he's created over the years, I don't really listen to it, but the fact that he's making it, I respect that. I care desperately about what I do. Do I know what product I'm selling? No. Do I know what I'm doing today? No. But I'm here, and I'm going to give it my best shot.
Hansel.
That's a scene from the first Zoolander. So what have you had to learn to write Zoolander 2?
Obviously, you know, I got to write it with Ben, which was very instructive because Ben Stiller, and he knows those characters very well. They're his creation. He was, I think, at one point said, you know, we're basically writing 9-year-olds. You know, there's no super deep psychology to them. So you kind of write them. They're kind of not formed people yet, but they sort of live in this adult world. So that was very instructive. And then it's just about sort of ping-ponging what we think makes them funny, or what we like about them and what makes us laugh. For me, what I really like about those two characters is they have the combination of two things that I think are extremely funny, which is supreme confidence and total stupidity. And in life, I think that's just funny. When you see someone very dumb who is completely confident that they're smart, and smart, maybe smarter than everybody, you know, that kind of forward-footedness I really think is great for comedy.
You co-wrote Tropic Thunder with Ben Stiller, and this is about a movie about the making of a Vietnam War movie, a movie that goes disastrously wrong. Had you ever auditioned or been in a war film?
Yes, I did audition for a war film one time, and it was terrible. It went so horribly wrong. I remember thinking, because it was one of these things, I think it was Thin Red Line or something. I was, you know, younger, and it was one of those horrible auditions. They're like, there's no pages, there's no script. And they're like, can you tell me about the character? No. You're going to go up to this place on 57th Street, and you're going to, meet with the casting director, and she's going to put you on film. And you go, well, what am I going to do? And they go, well, we don't know what you're going to do, but, you know, this is a very important movie. And you go up there, and they've sort of tipped a chair over, and they're sort of saying, like, okay, now pretend you're getting shot. Now, so they're asking you to sort of write the dialogue, create the character, do everything, you know, like on the spot, you know. And you think, well, this is no way to audition for a film, you know what I mean? Like, for anything, you know, let alone whatever. I'd rather just stand there and hold my name on a card and just say, do you like me or not? You know, like, it's a humiliating experience.
Let's talk about your formative years. You come from a very interesting family. Your uncle is the writer Paul Theroux. You pronounce your names differently. He's Theroux and you're Thoreau.
It's just something that, I guess, the way I fell off the truck. I don't know where the transition happened. But, all the people that sort of are cousins, even, you know, go by Theroux. And I should probably switch it at this point. But
too late for that.
I know. I think it's too late. I think the train left the station.
So your uncle Paul Theroux is a very well-known travel writer. Your mother is or was a journalist and author.
Yeah.
Your father.
Wonderful writer.
Is a lawyer. There are other writers in your extended family. Were you surrounded by books and culture when you were growing up?
Yes. My mom is very well read. I had a much more difficult time. I was not a great reader. I don't know how to put it any other way. I was, tested as dyslexic and, I was an unfocused child. So I didn't read a lot early on in my life and don't read that much now, if I'm being honest. I read a lot for me, but I'm not one of those people who gets the New York Times Book Review and runs out and buys 10 books and is done with them and passing them out to friends, 2 weeks later. I just had a really difficult time reading. I remember getting between school years when they sort of would give you your list of 8 books to read before you got back to school. It always felt like someone had just handed me, the Hillary step, and it was unclimbable, and oftentimes was. So I had a series of bad experiences at schools, just not being able to do the work, and eventually found a great school that actually was very focused on writing. It was one of these schools that doesn't, they don't test you to death or do exams, but you have extensive term papers and dense books you have to read, and ended up sort of catching up on a lot of my education in high school.
So it was in high school and you got into that school?
Yeah.
So you had a lot of catching up to do.
I had a lot of catching up to do.
Were you embarrassed that you couldn't read? Did you try to cover that up?
Yeah, it's humiliating.
Was it horrible when you were called on to read out loud in class?
Yeah, the first time I was ever called on to read out, I just could not. I remember the first word I was called on, like second or third day of this public school to read. And I remember looking down at the piece of paper that I was supposed to read, and the first word was the, which I could read because it's the first 3 letters of my last name. But I couldn't read a single other word. It was like just looking at Greek. And I was like, well, I don't know how to, so I sort of made up a bellyache excuse and went down to the nurse and was like, I got to get out of here. This is not going to work out. I remember calling my mom, I got to go. We got to get out of here. This is terrible.
Your mother's a writer. She must have been upset that you couldn't read.
I actually don't remember many conversations about it, but I think, I mean, she was very sympathetic, I think, and also not understanding, like, why can't you? I mean, I guess she knew, she would have to know that I wasn't great at it because I would, if I got handed a book, I would that I had to read or do a book report on, it was just torture. And as I got slightly better at reading, it was still just a slow moving process. Even to this day, I read things in real time. I don't like as if it's being spoken. I can't skim stuff in ways that I know certain people can. I have to sort of hear it in my head to be able to read it. And I think in a weird way, it's why, I don't think I could write novels or long essays or whatever, like some of my family members. I think I tuned my ear to dialogue. And I think it was something that I'm much more facile at, because I don't have to sort of set up the emotional or internal stakes. And, I don't have to, write these dense paragraphs of what someone's feeling or thinking. I can basically just mimic people on paper and write dialogue, and I think it was something. I think whatever deficiencies I've had have ended up serving me in writing screenplays.
Well, Justin Theroux, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Justin Theroux speaking with Terry Gross. Theroux stars in the HBO series The Leftovers, which is in its second season. Our next guest, Randall Park, stars in the ABC sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, the first TV program in 2 decades centered around an Asian-American family. The story is told from the point of view of an American-born boy whose parents immigrated to the U.S. from Taiwan. Randall Park plays the father, Lewis. At the start of the series, the fathers decided to move the family from their home in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown to a predominantly white neighborhood in Orlando, Florida, where he's bought a cowboy-themed restaurant. Randall Park takes the responsibility of portraying one of the few Asian-American characters on television very seriously. He thought long and hard before accepting the role as North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un in last year's Seth Rogen-James Franco comedy The Interview. Park spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne Marie Baldonado last Wednesday. They began with a clip from the first episode of the show. The father, Lewis, played by Randall Park, is speaking with his wife, Jessica, played by Constance Wu, about their new restaurant.
I was blow-drying my hair, and I figured it out, how the restaurant can attract bigger crowds.
What? How?
I need to hire a white host. Instead of people coming in and seeing a Chinese face and saying, huh? I thought this was an old West steakhouse. They see a white face and say, oh, hello, white friend. I am comfortable. See? Exactly. Not welcoming. That's why no to your face and yes to the white face. Nice, happy white face like Bill Pullman.
Randall Park, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot has been made about the fact that Fresh Off the Boat is the first TV show in, you know, two decades that centers around an Asian American family. I was wondering what you wanted to make sure that you did or didn't do to keep the show grounded and funny. You know, if this is kind of a simplistic way to put it, but to make sure that people are laughing with you and not at you. I'm just sure that it's just something you all have to think about very seriously.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, ultimately, having the goal of making sure that first and foremost, the show is funny. And really, I mean, not going there in terms of the stereotypical jokes, the easy jokes, the racist jokes, that was easy for us to avoid because to us, that's not funny.
Now, I read that you don't like to do accents, and Lewis, the father you play on the show, he has an accent. And I'm just thinking that sometimes accent ends up being something that is part of the joke, you know, the stereotypical joke. And I was just wondering, accents for parts or using an accent in auditions, that must be something that you've dealt with throughout your career.
Yeah, for sure. When I first started acting, I just wouldn't do it no matter what. I didn't even think of like the character or the story being told. As soon as there was an accent, I was like, no, I'm not going to do it, because I was just so used to characters. Whenever there was an accent, it always felt one note. It always felt like the butt of the joke most of the time. But over time, throughout my career, you know, I kind of learned to differentiate more when characters were making fun of the accent or making the accent a part of the joke as opposed to just a part of who the person is. And I felt like with Lewis and other characters that I've played, the accents were more a part organic to who the person was. I mean, my parents speak with accents and a lot of immigrants do. And that's just the reality. And so to have that be a part of the character, it wasn't a problem for me.
Now, there's a scene I want to play from that first episode from the first season, the pilot. And I want to play it because when I saw it originally, it made me think, you know, this series, it's going to be different. I don't know if it's going to be subversive, but it's going to show a different perspective. Eddie, the oldest son of the family, is having a tough time at school, and it's a predominantly white school. And he gets into a fight with the only other kid of color in his class, an African-American kid who's also kind of on the lower tier of the social hierarchy, so much so that his only friend is an adult. He doesn't have any friends in school. And so instead of sort of bonding and being different, the two kids of color actually get into a fight. I think that's something pretty nuanced and pretty interesting thing to look at in a school with a lack of diversity. And so the African-American student ends up calling Eddie a racial slur, and then Eddie gets into a fight. Eddie actually ends up fighting back, and the principal then calls the parents into his office. So the parents, Lewis, played by you, Randall Park, and Jessica, played by Constance Wu, are talking to the principal in his in the principal's office, and the principal is played by David Goldman. Let's take a listen.
Yeah.
And according to the lunch monitor, he kicked him in the groinal area, shoved a pudding in his face, and unleashed a stream of obscenities I can't repeat because God is listening. There were some words he used that I've never heard before, and I grew up in Boston. This is a very serious offense, Mr. and Mrs. Wong.
Yes, it is. We are very upset that you didn't do anything to defend Eddie.
Excuse me?
That boy called our son a chink. You think that's okay? Why didn't you do anything about that?
How come only Eddie's out there? How come that boy's not also out there? Where are his parents?
Or his 40-year-old best friend. And why aren't we talking about the fact that he has a 40-year-old best friend? The school's fine with that?
Fishy.
I don't think you understand. We're talking about possible suspension.
If you try to suspend our son because of this, we will sue everyone in this school.
So fast, it'll make your head spin. Hey, it's the American way, right?
You know about that.
That's a scene from the first episode of Fresh Off the Boat. Now, you are playing an Asian American dad in the show who owns a business. And yeah. Your dad, I think, was also a business owner. Are there similarities between your dad and Lewis, the character you play?
Totally. My dad, I was born and raised in Los Angeles. And my dad, for a good stretch, had a one-hour photo store in Santa Monica. And I would go over there and help him on the weekends. And, you know, it was a real struggle, especially as the digital age kind of dawned on us. People stopped going to get their film developed at these one-hour photo stores. So I could really see my dad's kind of struggle to kind of keep this business going and to keep it alive and to support his family. And it's definitely something that Lewis, my character, goes through with his steakhouse. But also, I was always surprised because my dad was more reserved at home. But whenever I'd visit him on the weekends at his little store in Santa Monica, I'd notice that everybody in that community loved him. Like, he was really almost a different person out there, just really jovial and talkative, and all the neighboring business owners would come by and they'd laugh it up. And I mean, my dad was a real man of the people, and this was something I never really got to see at home. And that's something that is really reflective of Lewis, the character I play too, because he's just like that. He's this guy who just loves people. And it was really helpful in terms of playing Lewis and my approach to him, just remembering how my dad was.
So I do have to ask you about the interview. And it seems funny that I guess it's just 9 or 10 months ago when this all happened. But
yeah. It's so crazy. Gosh.
Yeah. So I have to ask you about the interview. The film stars James Franco and Seth Rogen, and you played Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, or at least a version of him. And just to remind people, you know, the interview was scheduled to come out last Christmas, but Sony canceled the majority of the release after distributors decided not to show it because they were getting bomb threats from a group called Guardians of Peace, supposedly connected to North Korea. But James Franco plays a talk show host who secures an interview with Kim Jong-un. And the U.S. government tries to get the host and his producer, played by Seth Rogen, to assassinate the dictator. And I'm going to play a clip from the film. It turns out Kim Jong-un is a big fan of the James Franco character. And after they first meet, they realize they have a lot in common and they have this fun, they have a meet cute, they have a fun date together. And this scene takes place in a tank.
Katy Perry? You know, my wife must have put that in there because I've never heard this before in my life.
I love Katy Perry. Baby, you're a firework. I love it. I mean, I have this on. I listen to this all the time.
Really?
I love her. You know why I really like her? Because she has such a strong message for young women and girls across the planet.
It's so empowering.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, sometimes I feel like a plastic bag.
Drifting through the wind?
Wanting to start again.
Oh. As you shoot across the sky.
Sky. Oh, good times.
Yeah.
Dave, do you think that margaritas are gay because they are so sweet?
Did someone tell you that? That margaritas are gay?
No, it's just a question I have.
If liking Katy Perry and drinking margaritas is gay? Who wants to be straight?
Oh, not me.
Boring. Margaritas are great.
And whoever planted that in your head is crazy.
That's a scene from the interview. You do a really good job in the film of making him at times relatable, but also, you know, super evil and a crazy person. Can you talk about striking that balance? Because, you know, it's not like you're playing just an average bad guy, you know?
I did a lot of research as much as I could. You know, there's not that much information out there on him because they are just so secretive and you never know what, you know, what's propaganda and what's real. But there were pieces of information out there on him that I really identified with. there were accounts of him in international school, just kind of sitting there at his desk, doodling pictures of Michael Jordan and his obsession with the NBA and with American movies. I mean, these are all things that I could definitely identify with. Also, you know, him being kind of chubby and awkward, and, you know, those were things that I felt like I could bring into the character, make him insecure and sensitive at times.
Yeah, and then you do become quite scary. That's a
good yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, he's Kim Jong-un, yeah. You know.
Now, you said for a long time you were doing the acting and comedy on the side, kind of like a hobby. And was part of the reason you think you weren't going to pursue acting as a career your parents?
Yeah, for sure. My parents were definitely not supportive. And, you know, I totally understand why. I mean, coming here from Korea as immigrants, it's like a story of sacrifice, like most immigrant stories. It's about sacrifice. They come here, they leave their family behind, their friends and all the comforts of home. And they come here knowing that life is not going to be easy. It's going to be an adjustment. But they do it so that their kids can have opportunities that they didn't have, and so that their kids could find success and happiness. You know, statistically, most actors, most comedians, aspiring comedians, aspiring actors, they don't, quote unquote, make it, you know. And my parents knew that. So they were really, really against me even trying, because that's not why they made this journey. And it took me a while to understand that, because at the beginning it was like, why don't you support me? I have so many friends who are trying it, non-Asian friends who are, you know, throwing their hat in the ring, and their parents are like cheering them on. And here I had no support. But now that I'm older and I have a kid, I totally understand where they were coming from.
Do you remember the first time your parents saw you perform, and also the first time they saw your work and thought, it's okay if you do this as a career? This is what you should be doing.
One of the first jobs I did was a local commercial on the Chinese channel here in Los Angeles. The whole thing was in Cantonese, I think, and I didn't have any lines, but I was kind of the focus of the commercial. It was for these liver pills, and my character played this dad who comes home super tired, and he's yawning, and he doesn't have enough energy to play with his kid, and then his kid grabs these liver pills and gives them to his dad, and all of a sudden he's awake. And that was like the first job I ever booked, and I thought it was going to change my life. I thought it was such a big deal. And I remember showing it to my parents and my mom immediately saying, you have to quit right now. You are a really bad actor. And I look back at that commercial and I was so bad. I was really bad. But at the time, I was really hurt. So my plan from there on out was, you know, I'm just not going to tell them anything. But eventually they start seeing me in commercials, and I wouldn't even have even told them about these commercials. And then I'd hear from my parents' friends and coworkers that they were like so proud of me. And they would never say this to my face, but eventually it became something that I started sharing with them, like the news of my career, and they started being really enthusiastic about it. And now like they're like my biggest fans, and it's so cool that they could be a part of everything, including the interview. They were like really psyched about that.
Oh, that was
so
sad then.
Great.
That was sad then, because the interview didn't have like a premiere or anything, right? They canceled all that stuff after all the controversy came out.
Yeah.
So you couldn't share that premiere moment or something.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, hopefully I'll get a nice role, a lead role in a film, and you'll see me walking the red carpet with my mom and dad.
Well, Randall Park, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
Randall Park spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado last Wednesday. His TV show, Fresh Off the Boat, airs Tuesdays on ABC. Our next guest, Berkeley Breathed, has brought back his popular comic strip, Bloom County, on Facebook after having retired it 16 years ago at the height of its popularity. At the time, Bloom County was published in over 1,200 newspapers. Anthologies that collected the strip were bestsellers. The comic took place in a small Midwestern town and featured such characters as Opus the Penguin and Bill the Cat. It often lampooned politicians and pop culture figures, including Donald Trump and Barry Manilow. And although not an editorial cartoon, it won the Pulitzer Prize for Editorial Cartooning in 1987. Our producer, Sam Brigger, is one of Bloom County's many fans and spoke with Breathed last Monday. Breathed decided to revive the strip after the publication of Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman.
I watched, slack-jawed in horror, as they threw one of the 20th century's most iconic fictional heroes, Atticus Finch, under the bus. At the time, and this was just a couple of months ago, it made me think that there would have been no Bloom County without Mockingbird. Because I was 12 when I read it, and the book's fictional southern small town of Macomb had settled deep into my graphic imagination and informed it forever. If you look at any of my art for the past 30 years, there's always a small town flavor to it. So this summer, when Go Set a Watchman was causing an uproar, I went back to my files and I pulled an old fan letter from years ago. It says, "Dear Mr. Breathed, this is a plea from a dotty old lady and from others not dotty at all. Please don't shut down Opus. Can't you at least give him a reprieve? Opus is simply the best comic strip there is, and depriving him of life is murder. A hard word to describe the obliteration of your creation. But Opus is real. He lives." Harper Lee, Monroeville, Alabama.
Wow.
I hadn't seen it for 25 years. And I choked up, and I thought about the preposterously ironic impossibility of my literary heroine from my childhood demanding that I not kill one of her fictional heroes. The universe throws us some obvious slow pitches sometimes, and we need to be awake enough not to let them slip by. So that night, I found the blank four frames of Bloom County from years before in my files, and I sat down to draw the first one in 30 years, and I posted it on Facebook in sort of a what-the-hell moment, and then it exploded after that.
Is it strange to return to Bloom County after 25 years? What comes easier or harder for you now, writing the strip?
Well, no, it's a reverse question. It's why does it come so easy rather than why did it come so hard before, which is what it did. I never met any of my deadlines for 5,000 comic strips in the 10 years that I did Bloom County, not a single one. And it was because I was miserable. I was driven, but every single deadline was ripped out of my back end. I don't know why. I've long examined why that was so difficult and why the strip turned out even readable. But it's such a reverse now that I'm still trying to figure out and decipher what it is that's happened in the ensuing 25 years that has turned that around into something that I can't wait to get up in the morning to do.
You've written that you would drive yourself really early in the morning to the airport to drop off the week's worth of comic strips to get to the Washington Post where you were syndicated.
Yes. And I was driving material whose ink was still wet because I hadn't started that week's of strips until only about 9 o'clock that night. And by 4 o'clock in the morning, I had to get them to the airport and put them on an airplane to Washington, D.C. It didn't matter if there was a blizzard or an ice storm. And several times I ended up spinning on I-70 on the way down from my home in Evergreen, Colorado. But in Iowa, the weather was so terrible that by the time I got to the airport, often the strips had not been finished, and I had to get on an airplane with the strips, buy a ticket right there, and fly to Washington, D.C. while I finished the last couple of strips on the plane, usually deferring interested parties who are watching me who desperately want to talk about cartooning to me on the plane. And I'd get there and give it to a cab driver and give him $50 and hope that he did what he promised to do and get them to the Washington Post offices. And I'd turn around and get back on the plane and fly back to Iowa.
So for those of our listeners who didn't read Bloom County, can you just briefly describe the strip for us?
Actually, probably not.
Okay.
You can give it a try.
Well,
Sam.
I'll try. I'll give a little bit. There's some famous characters that people might know. It's Opus the Penguin, who is an earnest and innocent penguin. Bill the Cat, who seemed to be in part a parody of popular comics at the time, Garfield. Cutter John, who was a paraplegic Vietnam vet who liked to ride down hills imitating having Star Trek fantasies. There was Steve Dallas, a former frat boy who was a defense lawyer who often could be pretty sleazy. I think those are some of the main characters.
Sure.
Okay,
nicely so done.
You'll accept that. All right. Well, maybe let's look at a couple comics, and that will give people a bit of a feeling for it. You actually have in one of the earliest new strips, you have Opus, who seems to have woken up from a sleep after 25 years, who's worried that his friends are going to put him back into hibernation. And he says, no, I'm not going back to sleep. And the horror of 25 years ago, a world of Clinton versus Bush, a world where Arnold Schwarzenegger still acts in movies and Donald Trump runs around, spouting poo-poo sauce and Lhasa Apso hair extensions. Good riddance to that old nightmare. So it seems like it's like you never left.
Oh, exactly right, which is the whole point. Hearing my comic strips read as a transcript,
sorry about that. Yeah, I'll try not to do that again.
Sam, you're going to go to cartoon hell for that.
I apologize.
It's unfortunately something we have to live with, but they have pictures for a reason, let me tell you.
I'll just finish out the interview just reading some more of my favorites.
You do that. You'll see me out the door.
Let's look at another one of your recent comics, and this one features Binkley, who's a neurotic 10-year-old who has an anxiety closet in his bedroom. And when he's going to sleep at night, various anxieties pop out of his closet to torment him, and usually they're pretty idiosyncratic. So the most recent one has been George Lucas. Why is George Lucas one of his anxieties?
He's back. We're all anticipating the return of Star Wars. And this is a little inside baseball for some of my fans, but they know what I'm talking about, is that George Lucas, he has a complex relationship, let's say, with his own fans, and they love him and they revere him and they probably bow to him like Binkley does. They all desperately want him to stay back in retirement in their anxiety closets where he's safe from possibly doing any rewrites in any future movies. It brings up a one point is in the old days, I would never have hesitated in taking great joy in going after someone like George Lucas. And I pause now. And that's come with age. He's still an artist like I am. And we may tear our hair out over what he's done with his art, but we forget that he probably has an ego that can be hurt as much as the rest of us. And when I was 23, I would never have paused and I certainly spent more time with celebrities than I would now as far as satirical targets. I think I'd approach it with a bit more compassion now. In fact, I know I do. I don't like hurting people's feelings. I remember walking. I was in Santa Barbara maybe 18 months ago. I was scootering with my little boy down State Street, and I pass a fellow and zip right around his feet and keep going, and I realized who it was. And I stopped, and I told my kid to follow me, and I came back and confronted him, which I would never normally do. And it was Barry Manilow.
Who appeared in your strips before.
Yeah. Who appeared many times in my comic strip. And probably not in the most flattering ways in 1985. In fact, I was probably fairly merciless with him, as well people like Michael Jackson and others. All artists, nobody was hurting anybody. They were just doing their art, and I was going after them, which I thought at the time was part of my job description. And I walked up to him and introduced myself, and he remembered who I was. And we both remembered that he sent me a bouquet of flowers when I had broken my back in 1987 in a flying accident. The target of my meanest cartoons sent me a massive bouquet of flowers to my hospital. And we both remembered that, and we laughed about it. And he turned to my son and said, "This is one of the greatest cartoonists of our generation." And I turned to my boy and I said, "This is one of the greatest and most famous singers of our generation." And I realized I don't have it in me now to do that again. I'm not the same guy I was in 1985. Fortunately, my sense of humor hasn't completely been defeated. But other than that, there's a few changes.
You won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for editorial cartooning, even though Bloom County is not an editorial cartoon, and that created a lot of controversy. What was the issue there?
The issue was that the editorial cartoonists, the conventional ones, the ones that were on the political pages of the newspapers, were incensed. They were mad enough that Trudeau had won it 10 years before. But he was arguably really just a walking, talking editorial cartoon on the comic pages. Mine clearly was not. It was populated with a penguin and a dead cat. So the idea that I had infringed on their territory was not taken very well. And they let Columbia University know. They let the newspapers know. They released press releases. They spoke out vociferously to have my Pulitzer revoked. unsuccessfully. And it ended up a very funny scene because Columbia was so embarrassed by this time that they could barely give it to me before kind of ushering me off the stage and telling me to get the hell out of town, which I was happy to do. Never look back.
You said that you would be at a convention and an editorial cartoonist would be at the next table and would leave when they realized who you were.
It was something right out of Bloom County. I was signing autographs next to Pat Oliphant, who was, I think, a double Pulitzer Prize winner at the time.
Who you've said is someone who you admire.
Oh, he was a huge influence. He's one of the best. He was the funniest guy on the editorial pages in the 80s and 90s. And in any other time would have been my hero. He was my hero at the time. So I'm sitting next to my editorial cartoonist hero. And as a counterpoint to Harper Lee, he looks over to me and realizes he's sitting next to me. He gets up, takes all of his materials, and leaves the room. So that's it was putting a point on the attitude that the rest of them had. And when I spoke at the editorial cartoonist convention, they every one of them boycotted it. So all I had in the audience were mostly college cartoonists.
Wow,
those are fun days.
Yeah, well, he actually said at one point, there's a quote when the Washington Post read about this, that Bloom County was guilty of, quote, passing off shrill potty jokes and grade school sight gags as social commentary.
Guilty, as it should be. He was missing the point.
Well, Berkeley Breathitt, thanks so much for appearing on Fresh Air.
It was my great pleasure, Sam.
Berkeley Breathitt is the creator of Bloom County. He's begun posting new comic strips on Facebook. He spoke with producer Sam Brigger last Monday. Filmmaker Ho Xiaoxian has dramatized both history and contemporary life in his native Taiwan, but The Assassin, for which he won the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival, is his first dip into the Chinese martial arts genre. Justin Chang has this review.
The Assassin might just be the slowest, most deliberate action movie ever made. Certainly, it's one of the most entrancingly beautiful. It's the latest film from the Taiwanese master Ho Xiaoxian, whose camera seems to command not only his character's every word and gesture, but also the very world in which they move and breathe. Ancient China has never looked quite so ancient. Ho might well have directed the mists that swirl around a moonlit lake, the breeze that rustles the treetops of a birch forest, the flickering candles that cast light and shadow over his richly appointed interiors. The Assassin conjures a time and place that feels at once concrete and elusive, so real you could almost reach out and touch it, only for it to slip through your fingers. The time is the 9th century, during the Tang Dynasty. The place is Weibo, a mainland province that maintains a tricky balance of power with the Chinese imperial court. The assassin of the title is a woman in black named Ni Yinyang, who, like a homicidal sleeping beauty, was abducted as a child by a sinister nun and trained to be a professional killer. Now she's been ordered to take down the local governor, an assignment complicated somewhat by the fact that her target is her cousin, to whom she was once betrothed. That's about all you need to know going in, and it may well be all you remember coming out. Adapted from a short story by the Tang-era writer Pei Xing, The Assassin is Ho's first entry in the wuxia, or martial arts, genre. The plot is rife with palace intrigue and political maneuvering, secret identities and sudden betrayals. But don't worry if you have trouble following along. Ho has never been one to carve out a clear narrative path. He's one of a handful of directors working today who understand that movies are more than vessels designed to ferry us from point A to point B. Everything he shows us, from the faces of his characters to the movement of their bodies within the frame, tells a deeper story. Those familiar with the director's rigorous, contemplative style may find it strange that he's chosen to direct a martial arts epic. And sure enough, The Assassin turns out to be both an action movie and an inaction movie, where quick flurries of violence alternate with long passages of luxuriant stillness. This is not a picture to watch in a hurried or distracted state of mind. Nor is it the first of his movies that people will dismiss as slow and boring, a criticism that says less about the film than it does about the impatience of a Hollywood-nurtured mindset. Like so many revered and challenging film artists, from Andrei Tarkovsky to Terrence Malick, Ho doesn't just want to entertain you. He's intent on transporting you, even if he has to reset your internal rhythms to do it. In one exquisitely composed shot after another, the assassin draws us into a world where the images alone convey an almost subterranean depth of feeling. At times it seems that Ho and the cinematographer, Mark Lee Pingbing, are attempting to show us shades of red and gold never before introduced to the human eye. There's a bewitching scene in which Yin Yang spies on her target while he shares an intimate moment with his concubine, and Ho generates more tension and eroticism with a gently swaying curtain than most directors could manage with an arsenal of digital tricks. The assassin is played by the Taiwanese actress Xu Ji, who previously worked with Ho on Millennium Mambo and Three Times, and her acting is transfixing in its emotional restraint. It's a great, virtually wordless performance in a movie that seems to have more in common with a silent film than with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Throughout the film, we don't see Yin Yang do much fighting or killing. Instead, we see her waiting, listening and thinking, stealthily circling her prey as she weighs the consequences of what she might do next. In his 1998 masterpiece, Flowers of Shanghai, Ho painted an intoxicating portrait of 19th century Chinese courtesans trapped in a gorgeous, suffocating prison. The assassin, by contrast, is about a woman from an even more distant era, quietly laying claim to her own destiny. Leave it to Ho Xiaoxian to make a movie that can do justice to its historical moment and also feel triumphantly ahead of its time.
Justin Chang is chief film critic for Variety. The Assassin is now out in limited release. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.